All rise. The Illinois Appellate Court, Fifth Division, is now in session. The Honorable Justice Mathias W. Gilord is presiding.
Good afternoon, everyone. Please be seated. The clerk will call the case.
122-0788, Maya Cotton
v. Greg Picaro, M.D. Thank you, Ms. Esposito. At this time, we're going to ask the lawyers who are here to argue today to please step up to the podium and just briefly introduce themselves.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I'm Scott Howie. I represent the defendant, Appellant, Dr. Greg Picaro, and Associated St. James Radiologists.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Eva Loizon. I'm here for the plaintiff.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Mike Reagan, and I'm also here for the plaintiff. And the order, which the court nicely entered, said that we are to tell you what our plan is for splitting the argument. And thank you for the additional time. We are going to split it 15 minutes apiece. I'm going to be talking about the new trial issues exclusively, and Ms. Loizon is going to be talking about the prejudgment interest issues exclusively. And if I happen to run over, she and I have agreed not to be mad, and I may come up short.
All right. I did not get the name of the attorney arguing the constitutional issues, and I'm not sure if you're on any of the briefs.
I'm not, Your Honor.
Then let's get your name spelled very loudly and clearly, please.
Sure. It's Yvette, Y-V-E-T-T-E. Last name is Loizon, L-O-I, Z as in zebra, O-N.
Loizon. All right. Very good. Thank you.
Sure.
Now I've got you. All right, you know about the division of time. We tend to ask a lot of questions. Please remember we have read the briefs and are familiar with the record, so we don't need to have that repeated. We will try to be somewhat generous with our time if we feel we need it for a full elucidation of the facts of this case. We also welcome we have a whole squadron of law students from various summer externship programs here today. So they're all, you know, here to audition for you, for your firms, all right? With that, Mr. Howie, you may proceed when ready.
The court. Again, I'm Scott Howie. I represent the defendants appellants in this matter, Dr. Greg Cocaro and Associated St. James Radiologists. And it's good to be with you. This case arises from allegations that Dr. Cocaro was negligent in failing to detect the plaintiff's breast cancer, allegedly delaying her diagnosis and allegedly leading to injuries resulting from a delay in treatment. Two of Dr. Cocaro's co-defendant physicians, who treated the plaintiff after his involvement but failed to recommend appropriate testing, settled before trial. And the case was tried against Dr. Cocaro and his corporation in November of 2021, resulting in a jury verdict against them. In addition to the damages award, the trial court awarded prejudgment interest required by the 2021 amendment to Section 2-1303 of the Code of Civil Procedure, the Interest Act, which purports to allow a plaintiff to recover prejudgment interest from either the filing of the action or, in this case, the effective date of the statute until the date the judgment is entered. This appeal concerns the restrictions placed on Dr. Cocaro's freedom to fully present his case that his settled former co-defendants were to blame for any delay in the plaintiff's diagnosis. It also concerns the constitutional validity of the prejudgment interest statute. With respect to the question of the issues that relate to the motion for a new trial, the defendants are entitled to a new trial on the basis of trial errors in the exclusion of evidence, an accumulation of rulings that together unfairly hindered the defendants in setting forth their contention that the clinicians, Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Kanzler, bore the ultimate responsibility, were wholly responsible for injuries resulting from the plaintiff's delayed diagnosis. And this takes the form of several independent rulings, all of which combined to have a prejudicial effect.
What evidence was excluded on this point of this restriction related to wholly responsible? What was it that was kept out?
The argument does not depend on the exclusion of evidence, Your Honor. This is really in relation to the sum total of the arguments that we raise as cumulative error. The jury instructions, the debacle over those.
Okay, I understand about the instruction, but this is this first issue, wholly responsible. What evidence or argument did the trial court not allow?
That's a ruling that we maintain set a tone, and that it had the effect of influencing the issues as to the jury instructions, that less emphasis was given to the importance of establishing what the jury instructions were to be, what the proper instructions and the valid instructions were to be, that it affected the court's denial of the special interrogatory that would have tested the jurors' understanding of the instructions, especially important given
that. Can I ask you, you brought up the special interrogatory, and you cite 8 cases in your opening brief on the special interrogatory, saying that a special interrogatory must be given. A trial judge has no discretion to refuse that if it's in proper form. The problem is that that's no longer the law. It hasn't been the law for years, and there is no acknowledgement in your reply brief as to that.
That is correct, Your Honor. But we maintain that the discretion is still abused in this case.
But how could you maintain it when you didn't argue it in your opening brief?
So that's not what you argued in the opening brief, is it?
That is true, Your Honor. But the question of discretion and whether discretion was abused remains, in a general sense, an issue before this court. And whether the court was required to give that is not the issue. I concede that. But whether the court should have given that instruction and whether it was an abuse of discretion not to give that special interrogatory, that's the issue that the court should be addressing. That is part and parcel of the entire cumulative error, and especially relative and in conjunction with the confusion and chaos over the jury instructions concerning sole proximate cause.
You know, would you characterize, Mr. Howley, sort of the tone of the trial? Because the strategy at trial was to point fingers at the first two doctors who had settled out, right? Do I read that correctly?
That's correct.
All right. And weren't you, I don't think it was you, it was whoever was the trial attorney, was allowed to argue to the jury, was he not, that, or she, I forget which, that in fact the proximate cause of the injuries to the plaintiff were the actions of the first two doctors as opposed to this doctor? Wasn't that part of the argument?
He was permitted to make that general argument, but with respect to, and this is again a part of the, and we're hopscotching around a bit amongst the various portions, but it is cumulative error, so I think that's fitting. And part of the closing argument that was barred on the plaintiff's motion was the ability of the defense counsel, his ability, to say that this was, that the evidence that the clinicians were responsible was unrebutted.
Your position is that the first two were the sole proximate cause, if any.
That's correct.
Okay.
But they were able to argue that they only heard from one expert, right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. But they were not able to argue, they were barred from arguing that the evidence of the clinician's negligence was unrebutted.
So kind of the other half of that term, you only heard from one expert that gave you this testimony.
Correct.
Versus being able to say the testimony was unrebutted.
That's correct. And only talking about the defense's own expert, talking about the negligence, and not able to point out the absence of evidence.
The reason why the evidence was, the expert testimony was unrebutted, it had to do with the barring order that Judge Lawler had entered.
That's correct.
So rather than mislead the jury into thinking they couldn't get an expert, doesn't it seem a reasonable exercise of the trial court's discretion to say, yeah, don't say unrebutted, but you can say, quote, plaintiff's experts agree, and things of that nature.
No, Your Honor, respectfully, that would not be enough.
What is it that was excluded that was so unfairly prejudicial that we have to reverse a jury verdict? Is it simply the word unrebutted? You didn't get to use the word unrebutted, so we're going to reverse a jury verdict?
Not strictly on that alone, Your Honor. We are talking about cumulative error. But with respect to the closing argument, the inability, and no, it's not specifically the word unrebutted, because that, as I understand it, was not the ruling. The ruling was that defense counsel could not observe to the jury that the evidence was unrebutted. And it's not significant. You're correct. The reason that there was no expert to testify was because the expert was barred. And that is not what defense counsel wished to argue or would have argued. Defense counsel wished only to argue and ask the judge for the permission to argue simply that there was no expert to say otherwise. And that's especially important when arguing to a jury about something, not about what the evidence was, but what the evidence wasn't, to tell the jury what it didn't hear. It's easy enough to assume or presume that the jury will remember the things it heard. Maybe some of them wrote them down in their notes. But it's less reliable to think that the jury will notice things that aren't there. And that's the purpose of the oral argument, of the closing argument, is to point out and emphasize those things, whether they're there or whether they are missing, that will underscore and emphasize the strengths and weaknesses, the strengths of one's own case and the weaknesses of the other. It isn't necessary in this situation for defense counsel to tell the jury why the expert was barred. What's significant is simply the fact that there wasn't an expert there to defend the actions of the former co-defendants, the sole proximate causes in the defense argument.
But when pressed, the judge said, any argument that's properly based on the evidence in the record, including that issue of sole proximate cause, will be allowed. If you have if the evidence was there to be argued, the judge is going to allow them to argue that, right?
That's what the judge said, yes.
Okay.
But that is belied by the barring of the ability to point out this missing part of the plaintiff's case, or of the plaintiff's defense against the sole proximate cause defense. A full and fair and completely zealous advocate would be able to tell the jury what it didn't hear.
But doesn't it matter why the jury's not hearing it? The jury's not hearing it because there's no expert in the world that will come in and testify as to this. They're hearing it because a trial judge in a pretrial ruling, for some reason, barred it. Isn't there a distinction? And to simply allow the jury to hear unrebutted would risk misleading them as to why that testimony is unrebutted.
It would not, Your Honor, because the significance really is just that it's not there. Now, the jury can also be instructed, and I believe they were in this case, not to speculate about the reasons for rulings. And that is an adequate instruction to forestall that sort of misinterpretation or misunderstanding. The purpose of the argument is not to tell the jury that there is no expert in the world that would say this. It's simply to say that you didn't hear this, that there wasn't an expert to tell you that. And whether that's because no expert would say so or no expert could be found to say so is unimportant to the simple fact that the jury didn't hear something. And it's that hole in the plaintiff's case, its inability to respond to the sole proximate cause defense, that is significant to that defense and something that defense counsel should have been permitted to argue.
Mr. Howie, opposing counsel on these issues, opposing counsel argues that many of these issues were forfeited. Do you agree that they were forfeited, or do you believe that there was a forfeiture and somehow you have an avenue around that?
I don't believe there was a forfeiture of these issues. I recognize that there are rulings that seem to suggest that defense counsel did have some opportunity to make some argument as to sole proximate cause. It was not completely forestalled. The reason why the cumulative error aspect is important, is that all of these rulings combined in various ways to prevent defense counsel from making a full and fully vigorous presentation of his cause of action. The nuances of being able to say what one wishes and needs to be able to say on behalf of one's client at closing argument are critical. And the prior restraint of telling an attorney that he or she can't argue something that is absolutely true and undisputed is the sort of prior restraint that chills the argument in a way that affects the trial in important ways. I want to say a word as well about the jury instructions and the giving of instructions that, as it turns out, and as we can now prove, were not actually on the Illinois court's website at the time that they were given.
Well, the defense tendered those instructions.
That's correct.
And at the time they tendered them, they had been withdrawn. True?
If that is what it now turns out, yes.
Well, the defense knew that they were withdrawn because they came into court and said, Judge, those instructions have been withdrawn.
That was after they had been tendered, and then it was discovered that they had been withdrawn.
But then somebody went to the computer in Chambers, and apparently the official website that is the be-all and end-all of what the official Illinois Supreme Court jury instructions, they were still on the website at that point, right?
They were there again.
So
they had been withdrawn. That's when defense counsel discovered
they were on a cookie on the judge's computer and defaulted to the last time he was on the website. We don't know what was on the website.
True.
We know what wasn't on the judge's computer at the time of the trial. But.
Correct. Although recognized that there was legal press at the time in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin that recognized there had been some hiccups in the posting and withdrawal and the revisions that were made to the instructions were not...
If defense counsel knows to withdraw and they know they're going to an instruction conference, wouldn't they bring that with them, some indication, print it off and say, wouldn't they want to file it? Wouldn't they want to withdraw their own tendered instructions?
So, first, I'm quite certain that defense counsel expected to be able to see this on the judge's computer and fully anticipated that would be reflected on the Illinois court's website.
I've done a few jury instruction conferences, and I've never had counsel back in chambers to look at the computer. So that seems a little bit of an unrealistic expectation. I would assume you would bring authority with you to an instruction conference and want to tender it to the court.
It is the website that is considered to be the be-all and end-all, as Your Honor put it. And certainly that might be best practices, but if it is on the website and shows that it's been withdrawn, that's something that counsel ought to be able to rely on. And the fact that they were not able to in this case certainly is a unique situation. And Your Honor, I won't deny that this is... I've never seen anything like this. I feel quite certain most of the court probably hasn't either. It is a very unique situation. The fact that, and I want to emphasize it as well, I mean, certainly, as Your Honor has pointed out, these were instructions tendered by the defense at a time that they believed them to be the current instructions. Upon discovering that they apparently weren't current, they promptly notified the judge. They were unable to determine from the website in the court's chambers that they had in fact been withdrawn and therefore move forward with the ones that they had. It is this confusion we maintain that is a basis for reversal because it couldn't be established reliably what the proper instructions were.
Well, what were the proper instructions? If play that out, what did they tender to the court to give the court an alternative? If what is on the website wasn't the correct one, what was given to the court to say, well, no, here, Judge, here's the right ones?
So, again, Your Honor, I acknowledge that best practices would have been...
I'm not even saying best practices. I'm saying let's just go with what was done.
Under the circumstances, they were not tendered. They did not tender a different instruction. And in the ordinary case, that would be a waiver. again, this is a unique situation. It's highly irregular that the be-all, end-all of what provides the jury instructions can't be relied upon or seems, in hindsight, to have been 2 months out of date.
I'm confused how you're prejudiced by this, because if those two instructions weren't given, the jury would not have received any instruction on sole proximate cause. If that's your theory, that's what you want to argue to the jury, that's why you tendered those instructions in the first place. You wanted the jury instructed in that long form with that second paragraph. Now it's a prejudicial error to have given that?
The error, Your Honor, is in the fact that instructions were given that are now known to have been 2 months out of date. We're not known to any of the parties at the time, including the judge.
Just because an instruction's been withdrawn doesn't mean that it's legally wrong to give it, right? We give non-IPI instructions. It's not something we, you know, trial judge does happily or frequently or lightly. But just because you give an instruction that's not an IPI instruction wouldn't entitle you to a new trial, would it?
Under the circumstances of this case, Your Honor, where there was utter confusion as to what the appropriate instruction was, and ultimately the instruction that was given was not the IPI approved, unbeknownst to the parties, those are circumstances we maintain that make for enough confusion and misunderstanding that situation is an intolerable one that should call for a new trial.
Mr. Howey, you're a little bit over half your time, and I'll let you divide it as you see fit, but I just want to give you a warning in case you want to address the constitutionality at some length.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I would like to move to the question of prejudgment interest. Because should the court disagree that the rulings at trial deny the defendants a full and fair chance to present their defense, it has another issue to address, and that is the constitutional validity of the prejudgment interest statute. The statute runs afoul of the federal and state constitutions for a variety of reasons that are set forth in our appellate briefs. And while I'm happy to address any of the issues those briefs raise and that the court desires, I'd like to begin by focusing on three. First, the intrusion and burden on the right to trial by jury. Second, the violation of due process. And third, the violation of the separation of powers.
But before you start going through that bullet point of three, let me ask you a global question on this. Are all of your contentions regarding constitutionality based on the federal constitution and the state constitution equally, or is there a nuance involving some state constitutional provision that doesn't apply on the federal side?
They apply to both equally, Your Honor. There's not a distinction between the two, as to the extent that our arguments apply. In addition to those issues, the retroactive application of the statute to cases not yet accrued or pending when it took effect is an unconstitutional revocation of a vested right and would not be allowable even if the statute itself were constitutional. Turning first to the burden that the statute places on the right to trial by jury, Illinois recognizes that the right to a jury trial is a fundamental one. Indeed, it's a right that we properly regard as a cornerstone of our constitutional democracy. The 1970 Constitution was careful to guarantee that the right to trial by jury would remain inviolate, and an important part of that right is the right to have a jury determine matters that are in dispute, factual matters, not just liability, but also in civil cases such as questions such as damages, and what the amount of damages a successful plaintiff may recover. Since the jury trial is a fundamental right, legislative burdens on it are judged according to strict scrutiny and must be narrowly tailored to serve a compelling state interest. But the prejudgment interest statute violates that right by burdening it with a price for its exercise. Defendants who hope to have their day in court may only do so if they are willing to risk being charged a premium.
Well, the statute applies equally to bench trials and jury trials. There's nothing unique in the statute as it applies to jury trials.
To the extent that it does apply to jury trials, however, Your Honor, the right to have a jury decide those issues, or to have the judge decide those issues. The judge, and in the question of a bench trial, gets into questions of separation of powers, which are also a significant argument against the statute.
We've had prejudgment interest in the state of Illinois in commercial cases for over 100 years, jury trials and bench trials. There's nothing scary about it, is there?
Commercial cases are, don't scare prejudgment interest, Your Honor. I don't mean to suggest that we're scared.
I thought the sky was falling.
Pardon? I thought the sky was falling. Not at all, Your Honor. But it is, there are constitutional concerns that are raised by the new prejudgment interest statute that are not part of the statute that is
allowed. 40-some other states do it.
Pardon?
40-some other states allow prejudgment interest in personal injury actions.
Many under very different circumstances. Okay. There are states, for example, that provide at judge's discretion.
So this isn't a topic that's strictly verboten from the legislature venture into. They've done it for 100 years in commercial cases, and in our sister states, many states provide it. So this suggestion that it's this gross intrusion onto the legal process, what juries do, it just doesn't really, it rings a bit hollow in light of the full context.
Given, Your Honor, the fact that many of the statutes in other cases, in other states, provide discretion and allow for the prejudgment interest only at the judge's discretion, that's a major difference from our case. There are also concerns, certainly just involving the recent passage of this statute. Three readings rule is one of the issues in our case. There is also, however, the question of the removal of a vested right. In commercial cases, as Your Honor pointed out, there has been a prejudgment interest allowance for years, maybe decades. And so the assessment of that is not a change. It's not a revocation of a vested right.
But what it illustrates is that interest is a matter of statutory prerogative. Trial judge doesn't have any discretion in a money damage case to award interest or not. It's just a function of whether or not the statute provides for it, whether it's mandated.
And I'm sorry, you're referring to
current... Well, you had an argument that it encroaches on a judge's discretion to award interest, or this is your separation of powers argument. There is no discretion to award interest. Either the General Assembly has provided for it or they've not. And now in cases of personal injury actions, they have.
And it's that lack of discretion that infringes on the legislative, on the judicial sphere of powers, the sphere of authority that raises our separation of powers argument.
So what's the vested right, Mr. Howey? The vested right in the continuation of the law that says no pretrial interest? Or rather, continuation of a situation where prejudgment interest didn't exist?
It's the vested right in the defense. And the mere continuation of the law certainly is not something that someone has a vested right in. But the vested right to a defense, in this case, the ironclad defense, or ironclad until 2021, that Illinois doesn't provide prejudgment interest, doesn't allow it, is a vested right at the time that the case was filed, at the time that the allegedly negligent acts were performed. That's something that over the life of the case was a vested right that Dr. Cuccaro and his corporation had the right to rely upon. And there are multiple cases, the Lazenby case versus March Construction. That's the case in 2010 where the Illinois Supreme Court found that it was unconstitutional to abrogate the fireman's rule, an ironclad defense in certain premises liability cases that the legislature purported to remove. And the Supreme Court ruled that the fireman's rule was a vested right, the defense. The defendant had a vested right in that defense. And by taking it away, the General Assembly had violated the Constitution. That is essentially what has happened in this case with respect to prejudgment interest, where up until 2021, any defendant, had this case, in fact, been tried, let's say, in 2020, Dr. Cuccaro could have responded to a request for prejudgment interest with the unassailable defense that Illinois law doesn't provide that. In fact, Illinois law bars that in cases of this nature. So to the extent that the prejudgment interest statute imposes that that remedy and doesn't allow Dr. Cuccaro any longer to say that, to assert a defense that the law doesn't allow that, is an unconstitutional revocation of that vested right.
Mr. Howley, there's a section of the Illinois Constitution I don't think anybody cited. I want to read it to you. It's Article 1, Section 12. Every person shall find a certain remedy in the laws for all injuries and wrongs which he receives to his person, privacy, property, or reputation. He shall obtain justice by law freely, completely, and promptly. Given the time value of money, why doesn't this statute fall under the approval of the Constitution when the Illinois Constitution specifically says that a person who is injured shall receive complete justice?
Because that part of the Illinois Constitution refers to compensation. And compensation is something for the jury to decide, to the extent, or the fact finder. In cases of bench trials, it may be a judge making that decision. The point, though, is that it is the judicial branch, and in jury trials, it's the purview of the jury, to make the determination of what the plaintiff's injury is worth. Whether the injury is an economic injury or a non-economic injury or something that can be reduced to a damages award. That damages award is to...
Simplifying this down, let's say you have a case where the only thing at issue is medical, all right, special damages, imaginary case. All right, time value of money. You're injured in 2015. You get a verdict in 2018 for $1 million. It's going to be worth a lot more than $1 million verdict in 2020 because of the time value of money.
Correct. And that's part of the jury instruction 30.01 that instructs the jury to consider the duration of the injury.
The duration of the injury, but interest does not go to injury. Interest goes to the use of the money, right? It doesn't depend on what the tort injury is. It's the length of time that it takes the plaintiff to reduce that case to a judgment that's being addressed by the interest situation, right?
That's correct. And
doesn't do that. They're not given any instructions on what the prevailing interest rate is. But that provision that IPI of 30, forget the sub number.
3001.
Yeah. It's talking about the duration of the physical injury. Is it a permanent injury or is it a temporary injury? If it's a temporary injury, how long did they have it, right? What basis do we have that somehow juries are going off and calculating, making interest rate calculations based on that?
What we have, Your Honor, is a host of decisions and commentators from other jurisdictions speak at length about the jury awarding the time value of money. Do they make interest calculations? Certainly not.
Oh, yeah. I have three federal appellate court judges. And, in the world, a federal appellate court judge probably knows about as much about how juries deliberate as maybe law professors or Rand Institute scholars do. Our whole jury system is predicated on the notion that the jury does only what they're instructed to do, nothing more and nothing less. They are most certainly not given an instruction to calculate from the time of the injury and to somehow adjust their verdict that way. They are given an instruction like that for future damages, so we know in certain instances they are, but they certainly aren't when they're awarding damages for the principal injury.
So recall, Your Honor, that one of those federal appellate justices was the great Abner Mikva, who was a local Chicago product.
No, and I don't think Judge Mikva, one, I don't think he ever sat as a trial judge.
He didn't.
But more to the point, those commentators have recognized that whether the jury is instructed to do that or not, it is something that juries inherently do, that they recognize that money has value over time and that they necessarily make awards, perhaps not for mathematical interest, they don't tote it up on a calculator or according to a prescribed APR, but they nonetheless recognize that money has value over time and that and that is something that is incorporated into their determination of damages. And that as long as it is possible that that has played a role, then the automatic and indiscretionary addition of prejudgment interest on top of that runs the risk.
So we have this wistful thinking on the part of some judges and some commentators. That was all available to Senator Harmon and the members of the General Assembly. And they get to make policy for the state of Illinois, not, thankfully, not federal appellate judges or the RAND Institute. So they're free to reject that as nothing but unsupported hypotheses. And we choose to enact a law has some counterpart in over 40 other states, and which we've already been doing in some jury trials related to commercial cases. We think this is what is important for public policy in Illinois. I'm just struggling how that sort of a legislative judgment violates the Constitution.
It's just like a legislative judgment with respect to damages caps that were ruled unconstitutional in both Best and LeBron, where the Supreme Court spoke of a legislative remitter that was impermissible because it intruded improperly on the legislative sphere of authority.
To determine damages, not interest.
Right. If the jury's role is to determine the facts and then award damages based on the facts, that's the legislature stepping in that. But if the legislature is passing legislation to address some ministerial function, whether that's awarding costs or post-judgment interest, pre-judgment interest, isn't that much different than factual determinations?
It's no different at all, Your Honor, if the pre-judgment interest is understood, as I think we agree, to have a compensatory function. If part of the injury is the lost use of the damages during the period preceding the judgment, then it's compensatory in nature, it's factual in nature, it's something for the jury to determine, and it's an intrusion on that judicial sphere of authority for the General Assembly.
So along with the instructions, we give them a calculator and say, just figure it out, 6, 8, 9, whichever state we want to calculate the interest, we're at 6. I think Massachusetts at 12, is that the last one we saw?
It's kind of all over the place.
All right.
But there are, as I've said, there are various other restrictions upon the ability to award prejudgment interest. There are concerns about judicial independence.
How is that any more factual than a judge doing what the trial judge here did in simply calculating the set-off for settling defendants? It's the same sort of ministerial function.
I respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with that. That's a ministerial function because
it's based on a fact. It's the other defendants settled. It was a good faith finding. They settled for such an amount. It's a single indivisible injury. So these are facts that the judge understands, distills from the case, and then applies to the jury's verdict. How is it any different?
It doesn't change anything about the amount that the plaintiff recovers, because that's the factual amount. It adjusts the jury's verdict to award what the jury awarded, but accounting for a previous settlement that the jury is not entitled to hear about and can't account for.
Mr. Howey, we've got 2 minutes left, and you've already over time, but we'll let you wrap up in 2 minutes.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I would just like to take a moment to underscore that there are a number of constitutional defects in the statute that are reflected in our briefs, and I would stand on our briefs as to those. I would also reiterate the concerns about the fairness of the trial with respect to sole proximate cause and the trial counsel's full and fair opportunity that was not given to fully and vigorously and zealously defend his clients with respect to sole proximate cause, given the restrictions and the prior restraints placed upon him. With respect to all those issues, I would ask that the court reverse the trial court and order a new trial.
Any other questions from the panel? Thank you, Mr. Howley. You'll get 5 minutes when you come back up. Mr. Reagan, you may proceed when ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Mike Reagan, and I am one of the attorneys for Maya Cotton on appeal, the plaintiff. I'm going to take the issues in the order in which they were presented in the briefs, and I think that they sort of stand alone, and I don't think that they mesh together in the error, combined error, which Mr. Howey has told you about. So the first issue is motion limiting number six, where the defendant was barred from saying the settled defendants are wholly responsible. The court invited defense counsel to, quote, make a record, and the defendant only said that he wanted to protect the right to argue sole proximate cause once the evidence was in, and he knew the court had made it clear from discussions before that that they would be permitted to do that. And so going to Justice Mitchell's very first question today, there is nothing in the record which defendants were barred from doing or saying.
No. Hey, Mr. Reagan, I love the cut and thrust of a Reagan brief as much as anybody. But is it really possible that all of these issues were forfeit? How could that be?
Well, they were. I'm not standing here. For each issue, we have argued the correctness of what the judge did and or the lack of prejudice. And so we deal with forfeiture for each one. I have nothing in the brief here that says everything's forfeited and there's one global reason why it was. We have to look at each issue to see was it or wasn't it. And you may disagree with me as to some of it, but I would suggest that there is a great deal of forfeiture here and there is a complete absence of prejudice, which is a key appellate principle which has to be honored. So there was nothing which was excluded, no evidence. There was no argument on sole proximate cause that was rejected. There was no jury instruction from the defendants which was refused. And the topic of, quote, wholly responsible, which was the only subject in motion limiting number six, never came up in the trial. It was never mentioned again. And so then to the question of forfeiture, none of the procedural requirements for preservation of a ruling on a motion in limine were complied with. The argument was not renewed at trial. It had to be. No offer was proof. No offer of proof was made. There had to be one. And there was no demonstration of prejudice, as we've just discussed. The defendants said in their brief that they offered expert testimony on sole proximate cause, and they did. And they say in their brief to you that the evidence is sufficient to support a verdict that the delay in diagnosis was solely the fault of the clinicians. And they stated in closing that the doctors who had the responsibility to do more were the clinicians, Dr. Kanzler and Mitchell, and not Dr. Picard. And their instructions, which they submitted and never withdrew, were given. They say in their reply brief, they admit that they never said objection, but they said our intentions were clear, but we again get back to the point that there was nothing that was excluded. The next issue is the jury instructions, 1204 and 1205. And, for many decades, those three instructions, 1501, 12.04, 12.05, the long version of each of those is how sole proximate cause has been instructed on. And no court has ever said that those don't state the law. There has been a preference by IPI for doing it a different way, and we'll get to what the defendant's ultimate position on that is in a second. But nonetheless, there was nothing wrong with these instructions. Now, your questions have been, what was the judge to do? And there's no demonstration here that there was anything wrong with Judge DeCierto's computer. He invited everyone back into chambers unusually and said, well, here, show me. And he looked, he wasn't on his computer, he looked on the Supreme Court's website, and the old instructions were there. That's the only information he had. This was on the morning that they were getting ready to argue the case to the jury, and the defense comes in then for the first time and says, well, we think something's happened.
Now, their brief is pretty colorful. It says, you know, the veil was lifted for a while, and then it descended even more thickly. And I have to tell you, with all due respect to my friend, that it sounded like the Hound of the Baskervilles. And what the judge had was the court's website, and he had Rule 239A, which says that's where you get the official instructions. And we would have chaos if the court were to be over there with the jury getting ready to come out and say, well, maybe there's something else, and we're not going to do what's on the Supreme Court's website. So I don't see how that really gets anywhere. But the fact that the defendant tendered 1204, 1205 long form, plaintiffs didn't object to it, defendants never withdrew it. We offered, the plaintiff offered 15.01, which is the general definition of proximate cause, and as you indicated, nothing is said there. By implication, you indicated that nothing's said there about proximate cause. So if what they tell you is wrong, that is, the 1204 and 1205 should not have been given, even though they, then there would be no instruction on proximate cause, and sole proximate cause, rather, I'm sorry. And we have provided a case which says that if you're going to argue sole proximate cause, it follows that there will be an instruction on it.
Mr. Reagan, forfeiture aside, why do you believe that there was no prejudice from the circuit court's, Judge DeZierto's handling of the instructions?
Of those instructions?
You know, what Mr. Howie classifies as a sort of global, cumulative issue.
So, well, I don't see, I mean, I simply disagree with him that there was a global, cumulative issue. I mean, and when you take it all apart, it just does not hang together. It does not become global. And with respect to those instructions, I want to go back to answer the court's question, I want to go back to one of the first things I said about these instructions, that, you know, they've been in this form for, you know, pick a number, 30 years, 40 years, maybe longer. That's how they were used. And there's an interesting thing. I think it's on page 6 of the reply brief. The defense says, well, we reserve, I have the exact words in here, but we have doubt about whether these new instructions are any good, because they're preserving the right. I mean, no defendant is ever going to say in the future that we were entitled to use the new instructions, even though they were not tendered, because the new instructions don't say sole proximate cause anywhere. And so I just don't see that there's a global accumulation barrier. This is also a case of invited error. So you asked me about forfeiture, and there is forfeiture. I mean, if you don't tender an instruction, it's forfeiture. They did not tender different instructions on sole proximate cause. None. That's a forfeiture. They did not object to 1204 and 1205. That's forfeiture. And then you shift ground just subtly to invited error. And the law is very clear that if you give the court some instructions and say, please use these, we've tendered these, and you can't on appeal then say, well, that's error. And that's, you know, you just can't lead the judge to error that plainly, which is what they've done.
Other than, I mean, they didn't leave it at that, right? I mean, they did say, while they did tender them, they did try and pull them back. So it's not exactly the same way of saying, we tender these, we made no comment on them, and now on appeal we're saying these are the wrong instructions.
Well, they tendered them, and I'm not quite sure that I heard each of your words, Justice Navarro, but they tendered them, and they never withdrew. So that's the invited error, as I see it.
But doesn't the record indicate that they did sort of highlight, they came to a realization at some point that it might not be the correct instruction and tried to take it back?
I don't think they ever tried to take them back. There's nothing in the record, and I stand to be corrected, but I do not believe there's anything in the record about them taking it back. I will say that I believe that's the state of the record.
Well, at least they had some meeting. I think it's been characterized as unusual, an unusual meeting around the judge's desk looking at the AOIC website.
They had that. They did not give the trial judge any concrete advice. They said, we've heard. They came in on the day of closing argument and said, we've heard. They didn't bring anything. They didn't bring
the action of the committee. They didn't find the reporter. I used to be the reporter of IPI. They didn't find the reporter. They didn't find anybody else and said, okay, here's what's done, and this is in conflict with the court's website. There was nothing. It just said, we've heard, basically, and that's what it was. The special interrogatory, they didn't really argue much about that today. If anything, we did talk about the fact that you brought up the fact that their argument was grounded entirely upon the prior version of the statute. They had not argued, except in their reply brief, an abuse of discretion. They said they have an absolute right to give it. It should have been given. And they can't now, and I don't believe that the court now can entertain an argument on abuse of discretion when their argument was grounded entirely on the prior statute, which has been gone, as the court said, for years. There is a subtle defect with the special interrogatory because you're only allowed to ask one question in a special interrogatory, and they basically asked two. Because the first premise, there's a premise in there that the jury had to decide first before it was able to answer the question. And we've cited two cases to the court saying that that's an improper interrogatory, it's an improper form. There's no abuse of discretion here whatsoever.
What were the two questions that were the two prongs of the special interrogatory that you believe were improper? If you don't have it handy, we'll get to it.
The question, the special interrogatory, and this is at page 22 of our brief, the special interrogatory that was submitted was the failure of the clinicians to follow up on the palpable lump in Maya Cotton's breast, the sole cause of the delayed diagnosis of her breast cancer. So the first prong of that was the failure of the clinicians to follow up on the palpable lump. Was this the sole proximate cause? And so the jury, to answer the special interrogatory, has to first take up, was the failure of the clinicians to follow up and decide, did they fail? Was there fault in that? We don't have to talk about whether it was negligence or not, but they have to decide, did that occur, before they then go on to decide whether the sole cause of the delayed diagnosis was the breast cancer.
So it's not really two questions, but you're saying it's objectionable because it assumes a fact that necessarily wasn't proven at the time?
Exactly. That's precisely what it is. And we cited it on page 22 the two cases where one of the questions in some other case was the contributory negligence of the plaintiff something else, and the jury had to decide whether there was contributory negligence before they went on to answer whatever the something else was. And I think that it's pretty I'll rest on the brief in terms of the analysis of that. It's pretty subtle but true. They complained about the issue instruction in their brief, but they did not respond to our arguments on that in the reply brief at all. They didn't mention it here. Forfeiture again. The judge told them, if you disagree with these 10 sub-allegations in the issues instruction, then come tomorrow with a clean instruction and we'll make a decision. And they didn't submit an instruction. And obviously, the rule about instructions is that you have to pose the instruction. You have to bring a new instruction, or you don't have the right to take an appeal. So, if the court doesn't have any other questions, I think I've touched on everything. Thank you.
You're just on the cusp of your 2-minute warning, so
I appreciate it.
Ms. Loyson, you may proceed when ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Yvette Blazon once again for the plaintiffs. Your Honors, I know that counsel, my opponent, limited his argument to 3 points, so I will address those first. But before I get there are a few global points that I would like to make to this court. as you said, Justice DeLorte, when you read the constitutional provision, I would point out to you that the provision that you read provides this court with some guidance, particularly because it demonstrates that in the Constitution, what was really important was people who have been damaged in some way, like the personal injury plaintiffs in the case that we have before you, the goal is to make sure that they are made whole. And that is what the legislature did here when they passed the prejudgment interest statute. The prejudgment interest statute is rationally related to a legitimate public interest. And I emphasize that to you now to say that you should not be considering this under strict scrutiny. You should be applying a rational basis review. Here's why the statute is rational. It incentivizes defendants and insurance companies to evaluate their cases early in the process, within the first year. It incentivizes them to make meaningful and reasonable settlement offers. That helps the courts, and it helps plaintiffs.
That presumes, I mean, the practical problem with that is, in terms of what goes on every day in the Daily Center, is that a defendant would be in a position to make an intelligent decision 1 year after case filing as to what's going on.
Perhaps before any discovery has been taken or a lot of discoveries.
They're still slogging through motions to dismiss, or maybe there hasn't even been service yet. I mean, that's, as a practical matter, that's a problem.
Your Honor, I would assert to you that that is what goes on in the Daily Center. I certainly can't dispute that. However, the legislature is free to make determinations and to pass legislation that they believe will improve the lot of the public. And in this case, the legislature specifically passed this statute for purposes of ensuring that personal injury plaintiffs could get paid earlier. And they intended to incentivize defendants to do what they had to do in their cases to ensure that they could make reasonable, rational judgments within the first year. The legislature, according to Illinois law, in passing a statute of this nature, does not have to do it in a way that is absolutely perfect.
Well, and should the defendant get to take the plaintiff's deposition in that first year before they make that, regardless of the state of the pleadings, regardless of the state of discovery, should they get to take some sort of initial deposition of the plaintiff so they can make an intelligent decision on prejudgment?
Value the case.
Yeah, value the case.
I mean, certainly, Your Honor, that is the ideal goal, is that they would be able to intelligently and adequately value their case. But again, in passing the statute, the legislature can set the bar at what the conduct should be. And in this case, they set the bar at saying that within a year, defendants need to do what they need to do to make sure that they can take the step of providing a meaningful offer to plaintiffs. And the reason why the legislature did that is very clear, and it is that plaintiffs are frequently left in a position, and particularly in personal injury and tort and wrongful death related cases, they are in a position where they have, and I'm quoting one of the trial court judges out of the 23 that found this statute constitutional, Judge Slattery Boyle referred to the physical harm to a person's bodily integrity when talking about the import of this statute to tort and wrongful death plaintiffs. The reason why the legislature did this, because they understood that those plaintiffs are particularly vulnerable, and time is really of the essence for plaintiffs who are in a position where they may be severely injured, they may be racking up huge medical bills, they may be unable to go to work, or in wrongful death cases, plaintiffs that are in a position where their breadwinner is no longer alive to support
their family. What if a victim of a fraud, of a financial fraud, you're a victim of Bernie Madoff, and you lost your entire retirement. You lost all your money. But that person wouldn't qualify for prejudgment interest. That's every bit as dire of a situation as the personal injury tort, isn't it? It's reduced to a dollar amount. That's what we do. That's the best the system can do in terms of making the tort plaintiff whole. Now, we know that anything beyond that really matters, does it?
I would assert that making the plaintiff whole is certainly a big priority of the legislature. With respect to your specific question with financial related torts that, you know, rob a person of their life savings, under Illinois law, and I think you actually pointed this out, for over 100 years there have been opportunities for plaintiffs to get prejudgment interest in certain cases that do involve that monetary component. However, I would assert to you that the legislature has the authority to make a determination as to whether a specific societal problem is frankly more important than another one. And in this set of circumstances, the legislature made the decision that protecting plaintiffs that are in a position where they may be actually physical and capable of otherwise obtaining funds to live their life, their basic needs in life, needed this kind of protection. And under the law, the legislature is certainly free to prioritize those plaintiffs over others.
But what's your response to their argument, or to the argument, that prejudgment interest unfairly penalizes defendants for things outside their control? The defendant in a civil case, unlike a criminal case, can't say, I demand trial. The defendant might want trial today, but it's not going to happen for 5 months because the judge is backed up or witnesses are unavailable or any number of reasons. And in the meantime, this meter is running on the interest.
Judge, my answer to that would be to say that this is not a statute that is at all intended to penalize. In fact, it's intended to incentivize. And the statute is actually replete with mitigating factors that demonstrate to the court that it is not intended to be a penalty. In fact, in addition to incentivizing and creating an opportunity for plaintiffs and for judicial efficiency, it also mitigates damage by, number one, focusing on the highest written offer. Number two, it's only 6% interest rate compared to the Georgia case. I lost the name of it. We cited it supplementally. It's Philip Morris, Green versus Philip Morris. In that case, Georgia is charging 12% interest, and the Georgia court found that that was constitutional. In addition, there's a five-year limit on accrual, and there's also protection for defendants by ensuring that prejudgment interest is not going to be assessed in situations where punitive damages are available. So I would assert that all of those factors in the legislation demonstrate that there was no intention by the legislature to be punitive at all.
There's still a lot of factors that are outside of the control of the defendant. If the case, as it's been brought up, if the case is still delayed on caused by the plaintiff is still going to benefit by that interest. By no action of delay by the defense, there's no way just to parse that out and say, well, this part of the case was delayed really on behalf of the plaintiff, so we're not going to assess interest on that part of the case. This year or these months, we're not going to assess interest. That all goes to the benefit of the plaintiff or against the defense, right?
So, Your Honor, you're totally correct that there is no way to parse it out. But I would assert to you that in crafting this legislation, the legislature doesn't do it in a vacuum. They do it with all of the things that you just articulated to me and what Justice Mitchell mentioned before about what happens in the Daly Center and how sometimes discovery is slow. All of those things were considered by the legislature when they passed this legislation. And even with that knowledge, the legislature, within their authority, made the decision that crafting this legislation was nevertheless necessary to resolve a big problem, and that problem is related to plaintiffs being in a position where they are not made whole, when there are extensive delays in resolving cases, largely because it is financially beneficial to the defense and to the insurance companies.
That's my question, Ms. Blizzard. It doesn't matter who caused the delay. If in the absence of prejudgment interest, certainly in a commercial case, the defendant effectively has an interest-free loan until he has to pay the judgment. And so it really doesn't matter who causes the delay, assuming the defendant has the benefit of those funds in the period of delay.
That's entirely correct, Your Honor. And I would point out that the longer that it's delayed, the more money the defense is actually making, because they're accruing interest on their own insurance funds.
Probably not at 6%, unless you're in a highly inflationary market, right?
I don't even know the answer to that.
I think there was a suggestion and a footnote that Berkshire Hathaway said 10%.
10%, yes, for Berkshire Hathaway. But I will say that in the amicus brief, I think it's a great time to point this out given this discussion. In the amicus brief, there are statistics that demonstrate that plaintiffs are frequently taking out high interest loans just to get by, to have a roof over their head and food on the table. So again, I go back to the point that when the legislature made a determination that they were going to pass this statute in order to address that issue, they certainly passed a statute that was rationally related to legitimate public interest.
You know, one judge who found the statute unconstitutional,
yes.
My former neighbor in the Water Division and a good friend, Judge Maris, was concerned about the idea of double recovery, that this notion that juries are already doing this, they're already adjusting their award for the plaintiff, and by adding prejudgment on top of it, you're creating a windfall for a plaintiff.
Judge, with respect to Judge Maris, I don't think there's any actual basis for that conclusion. And if you recall her written order, her basis was the RAND study, which you mentioned several times, which was many, many, many years old, and not at all apropos to current sets of circumstances. And she also relied on a law review article. There was nothing within the confines of Illinois law to support that determination, and there wouldn't be.
Well, what about Judge Mikva? We heard his name was involved.
Well, Judge Mikva was, as you said, referring in passing. Judge Mikva's comment was an offhanded comment, speculating on what juries might do. But Judge Mikva, and I would assert, again, respectfully, Judge Maris, both ignored the fact that under Illinois law, which is 100% crystal clear on this point, Illinois juries enjoy a presumption that they are going to follow their jury instructions and that they're going to follow the law. And for them to make those kinds of assessments that you just described and were contemplated by those other judges, we would have to take the leap of rejecting what the Illinois Supreme Court has told us many, many times, and believing that they are not following their instructions and that they're back in the jury room with their calculators trying to make an assessment that the law and the court doesn't tell them to make.
Let me ask you, because your time is almost up. I want to talk about as the briefs illustrate, this issue is percolating in a number of cases.
Yes.
Not a surprising fact. Appears the 4th District had arguments on a similar case recently, is that correct?
They did not. Actually, those arguments got, the date got pushed, so
okay.
They haven't had the argument
and
yet.
And then we have another case in the 1st District in the near future, is that
That's
correct?
That's correct.
And that's all that's out there at the appellate level?
At the appellate level, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
If there are no other additional questions, I will just wrap up by saying, Your Honors, that as I indicated before in our briefs, it says 21. It's now up to 23. There's been 23 circuit court judges that have found this constitutional. And as you all acknowledged previously, over 40 states have prejudgment interest has never been found unconstitutional. In fact, in only one case, when prejudgment interest was instituted by way of rule, was there a subsequent adjustment to that rule?
That was Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, and that was in Pennsylvania. None of the constitutional challenges that were raised by my opponent before Your Honor are supported by anything in Illinois law, and they're not supported by our Constitution. For all of those reasons, we would ask that you affirm the trial court's judgment, not only with respect to prejudgment of interest, but with respect to all of the issues that have been raised before you on appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Howey, you may proceed when ready. I may have misstated earlier. You've got 10 minutes for your rebuttal, not five, per our earlier order.
May it please the court. Mr. Reagan envisions the Hound of the Baskervilles. I had in mind Heathcliff on the Moors. But either way, there was fog. And to the extent that it was uncertain and unclear and foggy, and a dark and stormy night in the judge's chambers as to what the instructions really were, it is that confusion that merits reconsideration, a retrial with the certainty of certain instructions. Mr. Reagan suggests that if we couldn't rely on the Illinois court's website as the arbiter of what the jury instructions are, we'd have chaos. But I submit that we had something very like chaos, or at least the judge's chamber's version of chaos, what passes for chaos in that sort of a setting, when defense counsel discovered that the instructions they had previously tendered apparently were no longer valid, and hoped to show that to the judge on the website, and weren't able to show him, and were essentially at sea, and lost as to what to do. Under best practices, under circumstances where the be-all, end-all of what provides the jury instructions could be counted on to provide something current, absolutely, it would have been necessary to tender an alternate instruction. Under the circumstances that we had, which were nothing like the ordinary, there was no guidebook, there was no playbook, there was no precedent as to what to do. And the consequential result was that instructions were given that were not the appropriate ones.
So it's your position that the website glitch somehow creates an exception to the normal rules of forfeiture?
In this instance, yes, Your Honor. This case is sui generis. I don't expect it to ever come up again.
All right. But that leads necessarily to the, you know, to the inexorably to the question of, let's say, you know, we agree with you on that. Then what's the difference between the instruction you would have tendered and the instruction that was tendered?
It would have been a different instruction. It would have been 1501. That's true. We know that now. Was the one that was valid at the time.
That's the instruction that Pat Ackler complained about in his newspaper article. Right?
That's correct. Yes. That's correct. And I'm not here to say that that's a better instruction or a more valid instruction or to defend that instruction instead. It's merely the confusion in this situation. And that's a situation I don't think the court should be interested in allowing to happen again. And if anything, it might incentivize, to use a word we're going to be talking about more in a moment, the Illinois Courts Office, the AOIC, to keep the website up to date and appropriate in all instances. With respect to prejudgment interest, I want to speak a little bit about counsel's discussion of what the legislature did and what it had before it and what it considered and took into effect. according to counsel's argument, and I hope I can accurately characterize it, the legislature understood all these things. It understood that there are plaintiffs who have to take out low interest or high interest loans. It understands that there are circumstances where it may be the plaintiffs who are to blame for a delay in the accrual of prejudgment interest. It may understand certain things about the cases generally and how things operate in the Daly Center in a broad sense, or other courthouses across the state. But those are the sorts of things that the Supreme Court recognized are not for the legislature to be understanding in a broad sense. They're not things that are appropriate for the General Assembly to try to legislate in a global way or a broad fashion. They are case-by-case determinations. That was the basis for cases like Best versus Taylor Machine Works and LeBron versus Gottlieb Memorial Hospital. Cases that, yes, they involved caps on damages and so very clearly involved efforts by the legislature to dictate the damages the jury could award or could be awarded after a jury verdict that was higher than those amounts. It found that those were inappropriate encroachments on the sphere of judicial authority because the legislature isn't situated to make broad decisions and broad pronouncements like that. They are case-by-case determinations, cases in which a jury may be asked to determine whether a plaintiff has had to take out a high-interest loan in order to pay debts that are necessary.
Would that ever be allowed?
Under a different regime, Your Honor, I don't know. I imagine there would be serious evidentiary concerns. I imagine a lot of defendants would be fighting against that. Given the circumstances of a particular case, an individual case, that's something that a decision a trial judge ought to be making. It isn't a decision that the General Assembly ought to be making. Maybe it isn't a question for the jury, but maybe it's a question for the court.
This might be unfair, but we have a separate provision that allows for prejudgment interest in cases on a written instrument, brought in a written instrument, and some other instruments. Does that also violate the Constitution?
Not at all, Your Honor. Those are cases, for one thing, in which typically the commercial cases involve a liquidated sum, a certain amount of money that can be determined to be a debt going back in time. And that's an appropriate assessment of prejudgment interest.
That's exactly what the court system does, right? It takes an injury and it reduces it to a dollar amount.
Well, it takes an injury that is not already a dollar amount. It is a broken leg, a delayed diagnosis of cancer, and reduces it to an amount. But it's not a debt that has been owing during that period of time. Commercial case is different. A suit is generally brought upon some sort of, it may be a directly a debt, it may be something that translates easily to an amount of money. But it's a liquidated sum. It's not the sorts of damages that are assessed by a jury, which require the sort of...
That's not a conceptual objection. It's a practical one, right? It's just, at the end of the day, both end up being reduced to dollar amounts in judgments.
I think it has elements of both, Your Honor, because I think in the commercial case, it isn't something that typically requires reduction to a dollar amount. The dollar amount is the injury. And that's the amount that is sued for. It's the amount that is or is not awarded. If it's awarded, it's an amount that can be said to have been due
anyway. In other cases, you have big fights over dollar ranges. It depends on when the breach occurred and that sort of thing.
Expert testimony about future economic losses.
Certainly. There are many different cases. It's a case-by-case determination, Your Honor, to be made at the level of the courtroom and not by the General Assembly. These are the sorts of things that the General Assembly is not suited to be addressing. And this is not just a criticism of the General Assembly or the legislature. It's something that is written into the Constitution as part of the separation of powers, and that's why it is set forth as a constitutional concern. The notion that the prejudgment interest in at issue here incentivizes settlement is a particularly chilling way of putting that. And I use the word chilling in more than one sense. It's chilling in the sense, call it an Orwellian sense. It's also chilling, though, in the sense of the effect that it has on a defendant's exercise of its rights.
Do defendants, I'm just curious, as a defense strategy, do defendants benefit from delay?
Case-by-case determination, Your Honor. There may be situations where that is the case, and there may be others where it's not.
Doesn't delay always work against the party with the burden of proof?
I don't think one can say that as a hard and fast rule.
Over time, memories fade.
It's possible that there is that time tends to help the party who doesn't have the burden of proof.
Another concern that the General Assembly might have is if you look at the Annual Report of Illinois Courts, there's significant delay that varies from circuit to circuit around the state in terms of the number of months to get a judgment. And we know that certain case types overwhelmingly contribute in terms of the bulk of cases in the law division, regardless of what county you're in or what circuit you're in. Is that something the General Assembly could have considered? We could look at the court system and say, gosh, is it really fair that a plaintiff in DuPage County has to wait 45 months before their case they get a jury verdict, whereas in Lake County it's 31 months? Isn't that something the General Assembly could legitimately be concerned about? How quickly, dovetailing with the provision of the Constitution that Justice DeLorde mentioned, the promptness of cases being resolved?
I think the caseload and the time to verdict from one circuit court to another, and Your Honor probably has a better sense of what those statistics are than I do, but to the extent that they differ, those are concerns that are certainly something that the General Assembly can consider, can even address in certain ways. Whether that is an issue that is addressed by prejudgment interest is an open question, but even if it is, the fact that there may be a societal wrong or a harm or a problem that needs to be addressed doesn't authorize the General Assembly to interfere with fundamental rights. As in this case, or in the case of prejudgment interest, to put a price on the right to a jury trial. In essence, not just to incentivize a defendant to offer a settlement, but in essence to coerce defendants into settling within that first year after a case is filed, long before a full and fair determination can be made in many cases. Again, being a case-by-case determination marks this as something that is appropriate for the judicial sphere of authority, an important consideration for the violation of the separation of powers that this statute represents.
Let me check and see if there are any other questions from the panel. Thank you, Mr. Howe. Anything to wrap up quickly?
Not at all, Your Honor. I would just simply ask and reiterate that I would ask the court to reverse the judgment in favor of the plaintiff, in favor of a new trial, and in any event to strike down the prejudgment interest statute.
Thank you, counsel, on all sides for your excellent briefs and argument on this very interesting case. The court will take the matter under advisement, and court stands in recess.